I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. As a parent of two young men, I get it. You need to have conversations with your kids, but sometimes it's tough to get them talking. So how do you start? Often, the generation gap leads parents and kids to simply avoid what both see as awkward conversations, no matter what it's about, school performance or their friends. When things are discussed, many parent-child talks lead to high emotion, little thought, and even less change. Dr. Wes Crenshaw says it doesn't have to be that way. Today, he'll point to how parents can transform the dialogue, get past the awkwardness, and really communicate with their kids. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. For many parents, having a genuine talk with their teenager is a dream come true. That's how rare they can be. Today, we'll talk about the do's and don'ts of how to have those conversations and four things you should avoid speaking about with your kid. And yes, I'm going to be listening closely here. Our guest once again is Wes Crenshaw. He's a Lawrence-based psychologist and author who specializes in family psychology. And Wes, welcome back. So good to have you here.
Hello, Steve. Good to be here.
You say the whole idea of a communication gap, you know, between kids and parents is a bit overrated. I'm not sure I agree with that, but why do you say it?
Well, routinely, it's interesting today, if people are in a couple and they want to take all the advice I'm going to give today about talking to teenagers, it's all going to apply. You'll get a couple or a family come in and they'll say, oh, we just don't communicate. And I say, prove it to me. Because typically when people say that, what it really means is they just don't like what the other person is saying. And so it's not that they don't understand or they speak a different language. Now, there are absolutely cases where people really do not talk and say things and express themselves congruently with what they mean. But most people just don't like what people are saying, so they decide they have a communication problem.
Well, and there may be a difference in families, and again, I might be getting a little personal here as the father of two boys, but you hear that, you know, communicating with boys at in those years is maybe a little more challenging than communicating with girls. Am I right?
You are absolutely right, and it is a little frustrating. And as psychologists, we haven't done the greatest job of figuring out how to make therapy conversation even applicable to young men and boys. I was going to go to a workshop in Denver at the American Psychological Association last year, and I got there and they had canceled this workshop. And what was the topic of the workshop? Working with men and boys.
Wow.
Canceled for lack of interest. I was
no
really
kidding.
I'm not kidding. Isn't that disappointing?
That makes no sense.
I think it was the only one.
I know. Even I know that as a layperson.
I know. It was really disappointing, and it was like one of the only ones that was canceled. So we're not figuring out how to translate communication skills, even in therapy, to young men and boys. And I find families struggle with this a lot.
And you advise them to what when it comes to boys?
Well, you know, certainly the old start young. I always say that. But I think also you've got to think about boys culturally, maybe even a little bit just by being boys physically, are more doers than talkers. And so the more you can be a doer, you can use metaphor, you know, gameplay being one of the popular ones right now to really communicate. You know, words aren't the only way to communicate, as we shall discuss a lot today. And so finding ways to be doers, to go out and be together and to act out the things you want to see in boys is really a good way to go.
Okay. Well, what are some of the best techniques you parents out there have to open up conversations with your teens? If you've got a magic formula, don't keep it to yourself. Please share it. Today's a great day to do that. 816-235-2888 is the phone number here. Again, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. So let's kind of set the foundation here, Wes. Apart from how any given family handles communication between parents and kids, there are some factors that just make it hard in general. Do I have that right?
Sure. The cultures, as we have discussed, if you just think about the years we've been doing this show and how remarkably the culture has changed for kids, and it's hard for even young parents to keep up. You know, at this point, if you had a kid when you were 20, you're about 34. And so there's a little bit, as it for having teenagers. So there's a little closer connection there. But now with culture turning over every 3 or 4 years in terms of, you know, sexuality and other social issues in kids' lives, it's really hard even for young parents to keep up. And when you're an old parent, I have a 13-year-old, and I'm a little older than 30. Mm-hmm. Let's just say I was born during the Cuban Missile Crisis. That's a long stretch. And if I didn't spend all my time talking to kids, I would feel very out of it. So that's one of the things that parents have to really be interested in their kids' culture. I just went to see 21 Pilots in Wichita with my son, and I was very impressed, really impressed, with the kind of audience that was at that concert. All the kids I see love 21 Pilots. And that was the most...
Well, 21 Pilots is a
Grammy-winning duo of young men from Indiana, two young men from
Indiana.
See,
I'm old enough to be out of touch with that.
Well, let's just start over again, Steve. and these young men sing a lot about emotion and their own struggles overcoming anxiety. Yeah. And they're very, very popular. They had a world tour, and they were in Wichita. And my son had expressed this interest, so we went and saw him. And this audience was made up of people 70 to 5. And there were families there, and it was a regular rock concert, but it was really good to see that many families joining together in something that is predominantly a kid culture. You know me, I just took notes there.
But so that's the kind of thing you're talking about,
exactly.
Things you can do with a son, perhaps, to begin to open up, talk, and have a conversation.
Exactly, exactly. And you got to find the right times for that. My son and I were in D.C. for a week. Just about 3-4 weeks ago. And we did a lot of museum and dinner conversation, and you're out doing things and seeing things and talking about things.
There's also this issue of each side of the discussion having competing goals that maybe can be in conflict a little bit.
Yeah, that's, of course, where the conflict comes in, because parents... This is like one of those duh moments, except it isn't. It's a struggle for people. Parents have to do parent things, and teenagers have to do teenager things. And those things are going to collide, and we have to have, as parents, some tolerance for that. We so become enculturated to try and make things easier for kids, or to try and give everyone a trophy or not make them feel bad so they'll have self-esteem, which is an elusive concept, I might add. Mm-hmm. And self-esteem doesn't come from being catered to all the time. It comes from adversity and struggling with that and overcoming. And so parents have to really stand up and explain and expect what they want out of a child. And they have to understand the child's whole purpose in adolescence is to pull against that. So those two things are a necessary conflict and shouldn't be evaded.
Well, that notion that adversity has to be part of the bloodstream here, man, that's hard for a lot of parents.
Yes, it is. And it seems to get
parents
harder.
Parents want to help, particularly in this helicopter parenting era that we live in right now.
Yeah, there's kind of two schools of thought on that, and there are the really disengaged parents. I see tons of those. And then there are the ones that sort of try to be in there and be controlling. And the model of parenting we see that's most effective is the authoritative model, where the parent really is a highly supportive parent, but they also have high expectations, and they don't knuckle under to kids and at the same time are supportive.
And that's the route to go.
That's the route to go, yeah. Yeah, as opposed to the old authoritarian parent or the laissez-faire parent.
Okay. 816-235-2888. We're talking about effective ways to communicate with teenagers. We're looking for someone to come up and invent the light bulb here. Dr. Wes Crenshaw is my guest. Let's go to some calls here. Allison from Leawood. Allison, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve. I love your show, and this is a great topic.
Oh, I appreciate that, Allison.
Well, my son is now going to be 26, but he used to be a teenager. We had an older daughter, and I felt I was a good communicator. And then my son became a teenager, and I felt like he would literally, especially when my daughter went to college, leaving him alone with the mother and the father, he became very non-communicative. And I joked that sometimes he would look across the dining room table at me with hatred in his eyes, because I was trying to talk to him.
Yeah.
And my motto at that time, I told all of my girlfriends that my motto with my son was to speak half the amount of words that I had the day before to him.
I think that's a good point.
That's a little familiar to me, yeah. But I'm walking a thin line here, Wes.
So yeah.
I know.
You open a good question here, and it's a little bit complicated to explain, but communicating with kids in that situation may seem like kind of a one-way street. And as long as you can sort of keep talking to them without talking at them, sort of read them. They're an interesting group to work with as a therapist because you have to pick up on what we call minimal cues and sort of see mm-hmm. what their visual response is, see where you're getting. And I think too many parents take personally that picture you painted so beautifully and feel like they should just sort of, you know, give up or they can't get through to the kid. Well, sometimes communication seems one way, but what you're saying and many of the things I remember my dad saying to me over the years weren't things I responded to and were like, gosh, Dad, your wisdom is unparalleled. Thank you.
Exactly.
That didn't happen. Now I look back and I think, oh, yeah, wow. So right.
Meaning you were thinking that at the time, Wes?
No, yes, I was thinking, Dad, your wisdom is it? No. was thinking, okay.
Yeah.
That's what I was
Whatever.
Thinking. So, right.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for letting me comment that. I mean, I'm going to finish listening because I don't think that this really ends for a while with young men. I think don't you agree that it's not just teenagers? Maybe it's just, and I'm not trying to be sexist, but it just seems like, at least contrasted with my daughter, I'm much more able to talk with her than I am my son.
Well, Allison, I'm sinking like a rock here because you said your son's almost about to turn 26. I've got a long way to go before my youngest gets there. You're scaring me here.
Well, good luck. Good luck.
When she said my son was...
Thank you so much. I'm going to go into Foo's Fabulous Cafe. Goodbye. Thank you.
Thanks, Allison.
When she said her son was 26 and he used to be a teenager, I felt like saying, you mean last week?
Yeah.
Because as we have talked about often, we are struggling with a generation of young men who do not grow up as quickly. And I'm not sure if this is a modern problem or we've seen it for many years. I've been doing some research on that, and it seems to have been a longer period than I thought it was. But they have a struggle until well into their 20s.
Talking to teenagers, that's our topic today with Dr. Wes Crenshaw, 816-235-2888. We're looking for great ideas, techniques, anything that maybe has worked for you over the years that you could share with some of our other listeners, 816-235-2888. Ron from Kansas City, Missouri. Ron, you're on the air.
Well, I don't have advice except for to the other parents out there. If you've got a son and don't have a daughter, my wife, I should say, goes to the Moms Club, and she finds out all the information about the high school through the Moms Club through parents that have daughters.
Mm-hmm.
So that's. But I'm hoping this is kind of divine intervention because my son and I have a road trip coming up here on Friday. And it's going to be 7 hours in the car, and we're going to visit the second of the final two schools he's going to choose for college. And the first school is a traditional, school, private school with a good liberal arts program. And he wants to take their television cinema arts program. And so the second school is more of, I guess I'll call it an arts trade school. Still well respected, but my fear is that if after the first year or even the second year he decides that's not what he wants to do, to pivot out of that and to find another major, basically he'd have to find another school where the first school is DePaul and he could choose anything. So the opportunity to make changes is and have a pivot and fluidity in the first school, DePaul, which would be my choice. He's not as interested in as the second school, and we've told him that it's his decision to make. And so I'm wondering, without shoving my idea down his throat, how do I get him to look at bigger picture and the pros and cons?
Wow, that is a very complex and multi-layered issue. So let me start with the drive, the road trip, because that is very applicable to a lot of other people. This is an area that has two views, and I have talked with a lot of my teen consultants, and they differ with me on this. I think of a road trip as a wonderful place to really have a lot of deep discussions. My son is finally going to, well, not finally, he's going to be 14 in the fall, so he will begin driving, and we're doing a big road trip next year to the West Coast, he and I. But here's where the young people complain. What they don't like is you're in a car and you bring up some deep topic, like, I think your boyfriend is a bad person or something. They experience this as being trapped. And I get it now.
Because they are.
Yeah, what are they going to do? Right. Jump out of the car? Hopefully not, although I admit I have seen people threaten to do that. So I think that time together is a doing activity. If there are things you guys like to do, go to games, concerts, museums, you know, whatever along the way, those are good times to be in the doing mode and the interacting mode that way. Now, in terms of the decisional process, which we have hit that topic a number of times over the years, because college decision-making or trade school or if to go or whatever is a critical decision in adolescence, I think you have to be super careful because you're kind of in a conflict of interest there. I think it's okay for you to tell him, here are pros and cons I see, and then really let him wrestle with that decision, because the more kids feeling they are in charge of the decision,
they own the decision.
You got it. The more serious they are about it. And I think it's okay to throw out, you know, Steve and I are big DePaul fans. It's okay to throw out the pros and cons of that for the pivot you described. And he may be able to see that. And I think you want to find some pros and cons with the other school to put up too.
And Ron, our caller, has made it clear here that it's up to his son to make the decision. You can't really go back on that at any point soon.
And we won't. And I'll throw out that I know part of the reason that, you know, if he were to make a pro and con list, because we've talked about it, obviously. And you know, he went to school at Columbia College over the summer, last summer, and took two college courses. And so he met some people there. He actually has his, you know, roommate, the guy he would room with if he went to Columbia. And so I completely understand that looking at him, boy, this is an easy transition. I've already seen success and I already have somebody I'm going to live with. And so I really have an empathy for why he would choose one over the other.
The other thing you might do, and this is...
You know, Ron, for what it's worth, we had exactly the same decision to make in our family with the same two schools. So I am feeling your pain, Ron. This is all deja vu for me here. Not to throw out school names, but I've walked this road. Yeah.
The other thing you might do is shoot me an email, Ron. I have a spreadsheet that is very effective for this. I made up with a client one time when we were trying to sort about 7 or 8 different schools, and you can assign weights to what your son, or your son can assign weights to what's important, social life or, you know, the cafeteria or the, you know, quality of the school or the party or the snowboarding or whatever. And you can really make those up and he can assign the weights, and then you plug in your rating system and it will kind of tell you, give you a visual image of how you want to make that choice. Shoot me an email and I'll give you a copy for fun.
That would be great. I really appreciate that.
All the best to you, Ron.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah. Let's get one more call before our break here. Let's go to Darius from Grandview. Darius, you're on Up to Date.
Hey, how you doing, Steve? I appreciate you guys taking my call.
Good to have you.
I just kind of, thank you. I kind of just wanted to give an insight on the teenager's point of view, because I'm actually just turning 30 this week, and I really don't feel a day over 18 a lot of the times. And a big part of this, I feel like the disconnect comes from when a teenager overhears a conversation that a parent may have with their colleague or friend. And a teenager may kind of feel like a statue or martyr in those kinds of conversations. And it may, you know, make the person feel like, or make the teenager feel like they have a disconnect with parents. Like the parents won't understand where they come from and what ought to confide in their peers instead of their parents. And it kind of, I still have this problem today with my parents. I feel like if I actually tell them what's going on, it will be kind of looked over and taken with a grain of salt instead of actually understanding the words that are, you know, coming out of me.
Yeah, Darius, I'm having a little trouble understanding the connection isn't the greatest. Wes, can you recount a little bit what Darius just said?
So there's two issues Darius brings up. The first is the sort of overhearing conversations about the kid or about things in general. And one of the things I say in the book we're desperately trying to finish is you're not on stage 18 hours a day. You're on stage 24/7 for the life of your child, for how you're interacting and talking and behaving with others. And that's where they learn. You know, not all communication is verbal. A lot of it's acted out. And then the second issue he brings up is about kids confiding in peers versus parents. And this is what I call the fundamental dilemma of an adolescent. And that is, if I tell you, then you're going to try to stop me. And if I don't tell you, you can't help me. And that really is that dilemma I didn't make up. That was a dilemma taught to me by kids. And so this is always the struggle. You bet. And the fundamental dilemma of parenting is, how much do you push and how much do you hold the child, which is back to that authoritative parenting thing. So Darius is correct. It makes it hard to make an open dialogue with kids if they think you're going to over-respond or limit their choices. And yet you have to do that in certain situations. If your kid says, yeah, you know, I'm dealing a lot of coke at school and I'm using a lot of coke, I thought I'd share that with you. You know, a parent is not going to be like, well, thank you. I hope they're not going to be, well, thank you, and give them a hug. There has to be a response to that. So these two dilemmas cause differences in what kids are willing to reveal and parents how they're willing to respond.
Hey, and what do you do with a child who says to you, hey, you know, I've got something on my mind. I'm in a tough pickle, but I'm not sure I want to tell you about it. And
I'll tell you what I would do, and I try never to oversell therapists on this show, but if a kid came in, and they do it with some frequency, and said, there's some things I really need to talk about, but I'm really afraid to share them with you. The best response is, let's find you someone you can talk to. Because if you say, well, if you can't tell me, I don't know who you can tell, gosh, that totally violates the fundamental dilemma of adolescence. So finding them someone, whether it's a therapist or a pastor or someone that it makes sense in their environment, is a good response to that. And then that person, if it's a trained therapist, work with teens, really knows how to negotiate what's shared and what isn't.
Yeah. Let's do this. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation here about how to have genuine conversations with teens. We're going to talk about four things you should avoid speaking about with your kid. And we're going to take your phone calls, too. And I hope listeners will call if they've come across good techniques that opened up dialogue with their teenagers. 816-235-2888 is the number. Option two is to tweet us at KCUR UpToDate. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to UpToDate on 89.3 KCUR. Well, this hour, we're visiting with Dr. Wes Crenshaw. He's a Lawrence-based psychologist and author who specializes in family psychology. We're talking about this challenge of finding ways to communicate with teenagers and what a difficult task that can be. 816-235-2888 is the phone number here, or you can tweet us at KCUR UpToDate. Well, are there certain parent-child personalities, Wes, that match up better than others in terms of communication?
Yeah, there really are. I tend to see people as being on kind of a spectrum between the anxious people and the sort of carefree people. And if you get, too far in either direction, you end up with diagnoses like anxiety disorder or ADHD. But you don't have to be that far in order to sort of fit somewhere in that spectrum. And where you get into trouble is if you get a parent who leans one direction and a child who leans the other, or two that lean too far in the same direction. So, for example, if you have a kid who's very anxious and the parent is very anxious, they will tend to overcorrect and overfollow and over-helicopter out of their own anxiety. Mm-hmm. And that just drives up the anxiety of the child. Whereas if you have an anxious parent and an ADD type of child or more carefree child, that works a lot better because the carefree child, you know, doesn't care enough. And so the anxious parent has a little more of a job there to drive the kid up.
How do parents determine what their matching rate is in their own family?
Little self-reflection is helpful, or ask their partner, because I guarantee you they can tell. But But trying to take a look at yourself and see, are you kind of a worrier? Are you kind of a helicopter? What thing do you need to sort of pull against? Or do you tend to be a little too carefree yourself and aren't always on top of the kids? And if you get two of those matched up, then not a lot gets done. You'll get people who just, stop going to school or something.
Right.
And the parents like, well, what can I do? So those mismatches make communication more difficult because they don't really understand each other at this kind of core neurological level, or they over-identify with each other.
How to communicate with teens. That's our topic today. 816-235-2888. Let's go to Jocelyn from Kansas City, Missouri. Jocelyn is the mother of 18-year-old twins. Good morning, Jocelyn.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thanks.
Great discussion. I think it's really valid. I just wanted to quickly say that the way I solved part of this issue with my kids was to offer what we call amnesty moments. The amnesty moment is basically, of course, we had to talk to it beforehand. Kid gets in a situation where maybe something's a bit over his head, maybe it's with friends, something happened, they don't know how to deal with it. So I told them, like, hey, if something happens, it's out of your control, you need my help. You also need me to understand that I can't freak out, or at least I will do my best not to freak out. I will help you solve the problem. And so it's not that this gives them a pass go card, get out free card. It just means that I will be there to help them figure out how to deal with the situation and figure out what the best way is. And I'm going to do my best not to overreact.
And does it work?
My son used it a couple times, and it had to do with, like he'd be with a group of friends and something happened and it was a little freaky for him or whatever. Fortunately, it was nothing really massive, but I also think it opened up the dialogue to keep them talking. And I always tell my friends of teenagers that if you can keep them talking, and even if it's just small stuff, then when bigger stuff happens, they know that they can come to you, because it's really... it really is up to them to let you know, like, hey, this is what's going on,
Jocelyn, I think she just said something really terrific, which is this idea of keep them talking, Wes.
Yeah.
Particularly boys. And your twins are boys?
I have a boy and a girl.
Boy and a girl. Okay. Yeah.
Well, this reminds me of our PLUS model, which is applicable here, even if you're not talking about sexuality, and that's pause, listen, understand, and then be sex positive is the usual one. But be responsive. And I think too often, you just said it nicely, that you're going to try not to freak out. The best thing to do when your child comes to share something with you is either respond calmly or say, I need a little time to think about this. And I'm going to go reflect on it, and let's get back together and talk about it. That will do you a lot of good, and it will encourage the kids to come back the next time because it didn't result in an explosion. Now, the more severe the situation, of course, the harder it is to do that, but ironically, the more necessary, because if it's really bad and you blow up, then you've probably missed your chance to be influential.
Mm-hmm.
In my experience, that's definitely true. The only other thing I have to say before I have the phone is I've always encouraged my kids to be able to speak to our family friends, mm-hmm. whoever that might be. We have a couple very close family friends, and they know they can always go to them if they don't feel like they can come to me.
Have they done
so
that?
I felt like I had my they have called one of my friends from time to time, and usually I think it was a situation more just trying to figure out what was going on with me. And that's okay with me. And she, she keeps it private or not, depending on what they say, and it was nothing really big, but I think just knowing that you have adults in your corner makes a huge difference.
Yeah. And in situations like that, you want to make sure everybody knows what the rules are. Cause in therapy land, we have clear rules set for those cases. So kids know where the line will be drawn in drugs,
exactly.
Sex, and rock and roll. And so you want to have that with your friends, too, so that the kids know what the limits of that are.
Ironically, my friends have taught me that.
Yeah.
Because she's a therapist. So she actually taught me that.
There you go.
Yeah.
Everybody should have best friends that are therapists, huh? So.
No, yeah.
Jocelyn, thanks
so much
very much. Yeah,
you
bet.
Have a wonderful day.
You bet.
Bye.
Again, we're talking about how to communicate with teens here this morning. 816-235-2888. Is it possible to communicate with teens? You can also tweet us at KCUR up to date. Does a parent's strictness play a role in how they wind up communicating with their kids, Wes? Do more authoritarian parents interact differently than parents who are maybe a little more lax?
Well, yeah, and it really all that whole authoritarian thing we were talking about kind of comes out of the theory of power, which is an older theory. It goes back long before me, but it's held up especially in organizational psychology, and I've applied it a lot more to families. And so there's different kind of power that parents can have. They have legitimate power. You know, I am the parent, and expert power. I'm smarter than you. And coercive power, they make you do things, and then they can reward you. None of those, that's how most people operate. None of those are really very effective with kids. They all have their place, but none of them are as effective as what's called referent power, which is the power you have when people want to be like you. Mm-hmm. Not be liked, be like you, to emulate you. And the more a parent can live their life and demonstrate to the child some path to follow, the more the child is likely to be influenced by the parent. And that sounds maybe idealistic. I've seen that many, many times. And the most effective parents I've seen are the ones who the kid, they're not going to jump up and admit it when they're 16. They're not going to say, gosh, Dad, I want to be just like you. That would be weird.
Right.
But it still is built into the system. The child looks at the parent as someone worth emulating.
Let's go to Mary from Topeka. Mary's a single mom. Mary, good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
Hello.
Yeah.
My question is, once a parent, and as you mentioned, I was a single mom, still am. My son has since left home, but once a parent allows themselves to be frightened or overcome by their adolescent's anger, how do you reclaim their respect?
It gets a lot harder.
It's a great question.
It is a great question. And I'm going to add to the list. There's really two on the list, and anger is one of them. The other one is what I refer to, and I'm not trying to be flippant about it, but I refer to it as the suicide attack. When the child is upset, and it can be a child of any age, 13 and up usually, they're so upset that they start threatening to commit suicide. Now, we want to take those things seriously, of course, but both of those used in the context you're using it are aggressive actions, whether they're being violent or angry or threatening to harm themselves. And those are tools of influence that the kid is using over the parent.
Mm-hmm.
So your question is, how does one counter that or get back to it if you've given in? And it is harder because they taste the power that those threats have. And what you have to do is not be held hostage a second time. And it's very hard because especially if someone is threatening to harm themselves, most of the time that's not going to happen. And then there's the time it does.
Of course.
And the parent, I will literally sit down and prepare parents for that contingency if I think there is a risk the child's going to use that as a threat or they're actually going to follow through.
So essentially you're saying at times you have to ignore the threat.
Good way to frame it, except you can't ever ignore it because it is a present threat. So if a child threatens you physically or threatens themselves, you have to call in law enforcement. Now, I understand there are a lot of folks in this town for whom that's the worst thing I could have ever said. That's the most fearful thing you can do. And I respect that. Encounters with law enforcement are not universally officer friendly. So I'm within that context, you cannot go this alone if your child is threatening you or threatening themselves, because the child needs to see that the consequence of making those kind of threats is that they are themselves isolated or limited or contained. And that's hard. These are the hardest cases. The caller brings up a really good point because it takes the issue of communication up about five notches.
Mm-hmm. And so
I want to say that second scenario has not happened, did not happen, but I was, it was more a lot of verbal I would say almost verbal abuse, and it, and I did cave in a second time, and that seems to really have sealed the deal.
Yeah.
He's not communicating at all now. So that's why I'm asking the question. Yeah. There was no suicide attempt, but it was enough anger directed exactly toward me in a very personal way that I really got scared and I was unable to exert any kind of, not reprimand, but not even tell him, calm down and go for a walk and come back and, you know, talk to me when you can calmly. I just caved in and he saw it all. So that's where I'm really stuck.
Well, it's like the one of the last lines in the movie Heathers, where Winona Ryder says, "The extreme always makes an impression." Mm-hmm. And the only response you can make in those extreme situations is to bring in a legally extreme solution. Because if you know, otherwise you're going to start getting violence. People start hitting each other and all sorts of things, and then it begins a toss-up on who assaulted who, and it really is...
Oh, no. No assault. All verbal. All verbal and very mean and very personal. No physical assault whatsoever. Mm-hmm. No need to call in law enforcement at all. Just rage that came from years of things that had built up over time.
Right, right.
So I'm just really wanting to know, how do you reclaim the respect of a son? That's exactly what I'm asking.
Well, you can't let someone live with you who's abusing you verbally.
Correct. And he has left home. Yes.
Yeah. And okay, so then you've maintained some respect because you chose not to live with that.
And he's left.
Scenario.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That is the beginning. That's why I say sometimes these things escalate, because the minute you tell someone you can't do that anymore, they tend, and it didn't happen in your case, to up the switch. It goes up, up, up from there, because then you're in that kind of a battle. And that's when having externals involved, whether it's mental health or law enforcement or anything else, may become necessary, even though I understand you were able to resolve it without that.
Well, he just left home on his own because he got a job offer in another state. But we don't have any communication now. Mm-hmm. At all. I feel like I'm still backed in the corner, unable to know how to get back to that
some
that
kind of relationship. Of yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. That's what I'm asking.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you've already taken the first step, and if the second step is opening communication up again, having a third party, whomever that may be. I went to the most extreme versions, because you can tell what I've done for a few years, but you can also have a therapist involved. I just, last couple of weeks, I brought in a couple of families of origin of people in their 20s to work out some situations that go back 8 or 10 years. And some people may say that's water under the bridge, but my experience has been that it's better to get people together to talk through their experience of what happened, and that they can reach some kind of an accord, especially if they're not living together. That's usually a safer situation for that.
Mary, thank you. Communicating with Teens is our topic here today. Ways to do it, techniques, whatever it takes. 816-235-2888 is the number. Dr. Wes Crenshaw is our guest. You can also tweet us at KCUR up to date. Let's go to Jack from Lawrence. Jack, you're on the show.
Hi.
Hi.
I was just listening to this, and I came out of the 1960s and had a son at that time, after years of all the unfortunate stuff you could get involved in that era. And my comment is, when I talk to him, first of all, a lot of people out of my father's generation, you know, you try to beat into the kid's responsibility and the moral compass, et cetera. And that was not very successful. In fact, that wasn't successful at all. So I had to think of something different because I wasn't going to hit my son. And what I came up with at the time was, I want you to know there's freight for your actions, and you're going to have to pay it. And as you know, if you do something illegal, if you do something, I'm not saying that I can be there. I can't make decisions for you. You're a young man. I'm not watching you 24 hours a day, nor do I intend to. Consequently, if you do something, be prepared to pay the freight because it's completely out of our hands.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
break a law. If you break a law, you're responsible. If you be mean to a woman, you're responsible. And I'm not saying that I'm not going to love you because I'm always going to love you.
You're just not going to pay the check on some of those things.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. And so that's not me being a parent saying you are grounded for a week. This is either the legal system or your compatriots or your friends or something along those lines. And there is a, you know, there is an action that's going to occur as a result of your actions. And it seemed to work because we weren't adversaries.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
I've had far too many parents in my career bail their kids out of jail 40 minutes after they got there. And instead, I have a client, a few years ago it was, who couldn't get a phone call to anybody and ended up stuck in jail over the weekend for a legitimate arrest. And she later told me that was the best weekend she ever spent.
Mm-hmm.
It literally sobered her up and emotionally sobered her up. And I think that people might want to reflect again. Jails have become much more troubled places of late, so one wants to be careful. But if kids know they're just going to be caught and released 20 minutes after they get there, there isn't a whole lot of consequence to that.
Yeah. Well, what do parents say or do most often, Wes, to make communication, you know, less effective?
Well, people don't like to hear this one. You've actually heard these words pop up today. There are four things I think people should not say in a conversation with teens.
Right.
And the first one is anything that includes the word trust. One of the big fights about you'll hear between parents and kids is about trust. And the child will say, but why don't you trust me? They sound like that.
Mm-hmm.
And the parent will say, why can't we trust you? Teens are not for trusting. I sit around and do nothing but talk to teenagers about what they do that other people don't know they do.
Mm-hmm.
Some teens have better judgment than others. That is absolutely true. And if you want to base some decisions on that, that's okay. Look at how the teen's judgment is. But having a big argument about trust is going to never, ever result in any change. The second one is respect. We've heard that one pop up today. The problem with that is it's just an emotionally laden word. Do I think teens should grow up to have respect for one another and their own selves and everyone else? Of course I do. But no one ever got respect from demanding it or, you know, yelling about it or anything else. If you're going to use the word respect in a sentence with a teenager, it needs to be something like, I really respect how you handled that problem.
Mm-hmm.
Or I have a lot of respect for the work it took to get those grades. Use the word like you want it to be used, but you don't ever want to utter the sentence, you don't respect me. The third one is manipulation. I almost slipped and used it myself earlier today. I instead said tools of influence. I caught myself. Manipulation is just name-calling. You're saying, oh, you're so manipulative. It's particularly misogynistic. It shows up with girls a lot and how people perceive them. And it's better to look at that as someone whose needs aren't getting met. And whether that's just or unjust is up to you to figure out. And the last one is kind of the nuclear bomb of parent frustration. And that's when the parent utters, I just feel like a failure as a parent. This one took me a while to catch on to. I didn't realize how personally kids take that. That's about the worst thing you can say to them. And we've all been tempted to say it. Try not to, because what that does is make the kid feel shamed because the parent feels shamed. And it's all downhill from there. Kids don't want to think their parent is a failure.
Let's go to Monica from Kansas City, Missouri. Monica, good morning.
Good morning. How's everybody today?
Well, thanks,
great.
Monica.
I just had something real quick. For me, I do have a daughter that's now 22 and getting ready to graduate from UMKC, but I do have an 11-year-old son. And what I have found a lot is a lot of people forget what it was like to be a teenager. You become an adult, and all of a sudden you're the parent, and you want to put your foot down on stuff or try to find, you know, ways around that. Where I usually take a step back as I see each stage that my daughter went through, and now with my son, of, okay, if I was in their place, what would I have wanted my parents to do or somebody to do, and kind of put myself back in their place. And that has helped a lot with conversations I had with my daughter as she was growing up, like, why can't I go out with my friends? Why can't I do this? And it was more like, well, you know, because I never see you, and I really want to spend time with you, and I'd really like to hang out with you. And it wasn't like begging for you to be my friend, but then she was like, oh, well, if you put it that way, you really want to spend time with me, which then opened up doors for me and her to have conversations and things like that. And same with my son. It's just sometimes I think we forget what it's like to be them because it's been so long since then. And when you kind of remember, I mean, I'm still the parent, but if I show you as they're still people, you know, they may be kids and, you know, and but still treat them like a person and that their feelings matter and that we can discuss this. And maybe I haven't gone through this, but I've gone through something like this, which then opens the doors and it helps to let them know that, you know, I just kind of want to be there for you in any situation. And it, me and my daughter have had, you know, she's always been able to be open. I know, I don't know, not, you know, everything. There's 10% of everything we will never know.
right.
I know the majority. And I see that with my son too is, you know, he'll, well, why can't I do this? And then we sit and talk about it, and which has opened up for me to find out things. Luckily, like they say, boys don't talk as much. I can get him to not get him to talk, but we can have conversations like people, not mother and son, but actual just mutual conversations.
Monica,
I'm interested.
I appreciate the comments, and I've got a scoot here. Any final thoughts, Wes?
Well, I think Monica brings up a lot of good points, and it's critical to think of kids as people and as partners in this process. You are still the parent. There's a hierarchy, but the minute kids feel condescended to, you're done. They'll either tell you that if you're lucky or just ignore you if you're not.
That's Dr. Wes Crenshaw, a Lawrence-based psychologist. Wes, always great to have you here. Thanks very much.
Take care, Steve.
You can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. You can follow me on Twitter at Steve Kraske. And don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. On tomorrow's show, if the proposed American Health Care Act passed today, how would it change your health care? We'll try to answer your questions tomorrow. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Claire Tadakoro. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.